Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books and Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ricardo, and in this podcast, I'm talking to Melissa Montgomery about her book, The Tale of Genji, A Visual Companion. This was published by Princeton University Press in 2018, and it's a really beautifully produced book and lavishly illustrated. And Melissa has succeeded, in my view, in creating a facsimile of sorts of the Harvard Art Museum's Genji album, the oldest dated complete set of Genji illustrations known to exist. It was finished in 1510 by the painter Tosa Mitsunobu and 6 calligraphers, and so the Visual Companion is the very first publication to reproduce the album in its entirety, and also to introduce each chapter of the tale as well. In this podcast, Melissa and I will be talking about the production and the commission of the album and its visual and aesthetic agenda, as well as the materials and techniques applied, and crucially, how to decode the visually loaded images of the paintings. So do get ready for an exciting hour ahead. And thank you once again so much for listening to the New Books Networks and for subscribing to the podcast. I hope you enjoy this one. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Hi, Ricardo. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining me today. Now, before we delve into the world of Genji, would you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I teach Japanese art history at Harvard University, where I've taught since 2005. Before that, I taught at Columbia University from the year 2000, which was the year that I received my PhD in the history of Japanese art from Princeton University. At Harvard, I teach a range of courses from the introduction to Japanese art, from the prehistoric period to contemporary Japanese art, to various seminars, like a seminar on gender in Japanese art, museum-based courses, and seminars on Buddhist art, like a recent one on the Lotus Sutra, as well as a seminar on The Tale of Genji, where we read the entire book from start to finish over the course of a semester. That's a course I've been teaching for almost 20 years. I also teach The Tale of Genji in Harvard's General Humanities curriculum in a year-long course for about 90 freshmen on essential works in literature and philosophy. The students there only have 1 or 2 weeks with Genji. And depending on which semester I teach it, Murasaki Shikibu might appear alongside Homer, Aristotle, and Shakespeare, as well as Frederick Douglass, Jane Austen, and Virginia Woolf. But it's been really great for me to read Genji in the context of those other books. So those are some of the things that I teach. And as you know, my research interests in recent years have been intensely focused on The Tale of Genji from literary and art historical perspectives. But my first book, Tosa Mitsunobu and the Small Scroll in Medieval Japan, focused on medieval narrative hand scrolls and issues related to visual storytelling. And I put forward a methodology for analyzing text and images that runs throughout all my work, one that tries to prioritize holistic analyses grounded in historical archival research.
Wow, this is so great. And sets us up perfectly for everything that is hopefully to come in the next few minutes, talking about The Tale of Genji, A Visual Companion, first of all, which discusses, in fact, one particular album of Genji paintings. And this album is today in the collection of the Harvard Art Museum, which I would imagine you have great access to, and indeed you thank everybody at the museum as well for providing that access to yourself as well as your students and other researchers, making it really accessible, which you do through this book as well. So this book is beautifully illustrated with each chapter and each album leaf illustrated in beautifully colored illustrations, and then with elaborations on each of the chapters. So it's a really beautiful object itself. And as I said, it is a comprehensive study of Genji paintings, and in fact, the earliest complete album of Genji paintings and calligraphy, so dated to 1510. And I'd be curious to learn how you first came across the album and then sort of started your research on it.
Yes. Oh, thank you very much for your kind words about the book. One of my goals was to do the album justice and to have readers get a sense of what it's like to actually be in proximity to the album itself and to create almost like a facsimile so that you could hold the album in your hands like a medieval reader would have done, enjoying both the text and the images as a sort of actual approximation of that original reading experience. So the album is actually something that's been in my life since I was a graduate student. I started researching the album when I was working on my dissertation, which was on the small scrolls of the artist Tosa Mitsunobu. He is, of course, the artist of the album. He produced all of the 54 painting leaves in the album. And I began that work in the 1990s. The album, though, really its importance first came to be known to the world through the work of the professor Chino Kaori, the late professor Chino Kaori, who taught at Gakushin University. She, along with Ikeda Shinobu and Kamei Wakana, published a special edition, a special volume of the Japanese art history journal Kokka on the album, which for the first time reproduced all of its 108 leaves, so the 54 paintings and the 54 calligraphy leaves in the album. And each of those three scholars provided really important contextual essays about the work. And Professor Chino, she was my dissertation advisee when I did my research in Japan. She included me along with a whole team of a range of different scholars, junior to senior, in that project. So a lot of us then got to write short excerpts and explanations about the individual chapters in the album. And she was really the first to recognize the album's importance as a Muromachi object. Before then, I think a lot of Tosa school Genji albums had been kind of dismissed as being pretty uninteresting. There are many of them from the Edo period onward. But what Professor Chino noticed was that this was really an authentic Muromachi work. And she and other scholars had been in the process of really reevaluating the artistic practice of Tosa Mitsunobu. And so this became an integral object in telling that story. So I'll just give another little exciting moment of kind of discovery about this album. And that was, so after the journal had been published and that special edition on the album had been published, we learned a lot about the album. The calligraphy scholar Kasashima Tadayuki, who's now at the Idemitsu Museum, he was able to identify most of the six calligraphers, the men who wrote the texts for the album, by pure stylistic analysis, which was amazing. And then after the journal was published, I went back to Princeton, where I was finishing my dissertation. And because of Kasashima's research, we all knew that one of those calligraphers was Sanjo Nishi Sanetaka, this incredibly important historical figure who worked closely with the artist Tosa Mitsunobu. And I recount their collaborative relationship in my book on Mitsunobu. He worked on over 12 projects with this artist. And so knowing that he was one of the calligraphers, I could then turn to his diary, his incredible diary, a 60-year-long diary, and try to discover if there was some reference to this particular album project. And sure enough, one night I decided to take a look, and within a couple of hours had determined that he gave a kind of blow-by-blow account of the production of this album. And that was astounding and really exciting to see, because he named some of the calligraphers that Kasashima Tadayuki had identified, but he also provided a whole wealth of details about the patron. And so for the first time, we were able to then determine that a Genji album had been commissioned by a young warrior, essentially. And that was important because previously, I think a lot of these Tosa Genji albums, it had been assumed that they were made for members of the court and aristocracy purely because of the subject matter of the Tale of Genji, which is rooted in that world. So now, with this very clear evidence that it had been commissioned by someone outside of the capital and someone actually from the warrior class, this kind of opened up a whole new area of research for thinking about the reception of the Tale of Genji in these different classes in the pre-modern period.
Wow, this is great, Melissa. Thank you. I think you're being very generous with referencing other scholars who have worked on the topic as well.
Well, actually, the Tale of Genji, there has been so much scholarship on it that sometimes the process is, I have an idea, and now let me see who said it before. And you have to kind of go back and try to give credit to people who've had these ideas in the past.
Before we delve further into this particular visual interpretation of the Tale of Genji, I thought we could first sort of set the scene, so to speak, for our listeners and talk about the tale itself in a bit more detail. The Tale of Genji was authored in the first half of the 11th century by a woman, Murasaki Shikibu. Murasaki was a court lady at the Heian court of Japan. Now, I'm really curious to understand what the position of women at the Heian court was, which allowed their writings, and not that of men, to become canonical, as indeed the Tale of Genji did. And then also, maybe more generally, what the historical context was that generated this enormous and complex work.
Thank you. That's a big topic. In terms of your question about how a woman came to author what's considered Japan's most celebrated work of fiction, one of the important things to keep in mind is that at the time that Murasaki Shikibu wrote The Tale of Genji, the monogatari, or the tale, as a genre, was disparaged. And so this was something that was considered to be a work appropriate for women's writing. It was written in kana, the kana syllabary, so not the Sinitic logographs of the texts that would have been written in history and official documents and so forth. And therefore, she was kind of able to fly under the radar, so to speak, and to write a tale that used all of the tropes and conventions of romance tales, but to, at the same time, assert her own political messages and to show what was possible in the tale genre in terms of its allusions to every genre, other genre of literature and writing, from those done in Japanese to classical Chinese literature and philosophy and history. So the form itself was one that she was ascribed as a female author. She had sort of permission structure, so to speak, to write in that mode. But it then allowed her to create this incredible work of art for that reason, in which she does seem to be attempting to elevate the tale as a genre and to say, sort of look at all that it can do. And in terms of it becoming canonical, I think one important fact is simply the scale of the text. So 1,300 pages in the most recent English translation, 795 waka, and hundreds of characters make it like something that had never been done before, and like nothing that comes afterward. And for that reason, a lot of the voices of authority in terms of male poets and so forth from the 13th century and even earlier onward recognized the importance of this book and championed it as one that needed to be known by anyone who wanted to practice literature themselves. And it's stating that its poetry needed to be known by anyone who wanted themselves to be considered a practitioner of verse.
And this seems to have also sort of translated into the visual arts as well, with numerous visual interpretations of the tale throughout the centuries and indeed all the way to the present day. Let's talk a bit more about this process of visual adaptations or interpretations. And maybe you could do this by, coming back to the the Harvard album?
Sure. So it's thought that visual representations of the tale of Genji began almost immediately after the work was written. The oldest extant fragments of texts and images of the work that we have is actually from the 12th century, so about roughly a little over 100 years after Murasaki Shikibu wrote the book. And those survive in fragmentary form, as I mentioned. They're about they come from scenes from 20 different chapters. It's thought that originally those scrolls were a complete copy of all the 54 chapters, although the texts are just summaries. They're not the full text of the tale. Those are national treasures in Japan. And there's a recent book in English by Reggie Jackson that is devoted to those objects in particular. So those are sort of the benchmark for art historians in terms of Genji images. But what's interesting is that aside from two fragments of one hand scroll from the 13th century, nothing survives until the 1510 album. And so we have roughly 500 years from the time the tale was written until the 16th century album at Harvard, where we're missing Genji paintings. And so that is one sort of giant mystery as to what happened in between the 12th century scrolls and the 16th century album. But we can certainly assume that a great amount of reification of the visual language of Genji occurred, that we have a kind of fixed Genji iconography pretty early on. There are, although not extant paintings, there are texts that describe Genji images that tell us this as well.
Wow, okay, so we're sort of starting to delve into this album a bit more. And I would love to talk about text-image relation based on the Harvard album. And so you described this quite beautifully in the book, and so maybe you can give our listeners a little taster of what is in the book by describing how you envisage the production process of this particular album, for example, how it might have unfolded, and who were the agents involved in this process? Which scenes, for example, and which poetry excerpts were chosen to stand for each of the 54 chapters of the written tale? And who got to choose anyway? Why does the album give preference to waka, so to poetry, even though the tale itself is primarily composed of prose? And then there are all sorts of other questions, for example, you know, reference made to contemporary culture, for example, as seen in the choice of clothing. And when would the artist draw on historical Heian court culture instead? Maybe we can do this by looking at one or two example chapters and paintings in the book.
Sure. Why don't I start, actually, though, with a little just account of what an album is, in case your viewers, your listeners aren't familiar with the album format, since I've already kind of jumped ahead and explained leaves without actually explaining how they're inserted into an album. So the album today consists of two volumes. It was remounted in 1998, but originally it was probably a single volume of paintings consisting of square pieces of paper that are roughly 24 centimeters by 18 centimeters. And these are called shikishi in Japanese. And so we have those paintings, and they are mounted, they're actually glued side by side then with a text leaf, which is the exact same dimensions. And in the Harvard album, those text leaves are dyed 5 different colors, and they're decorated with borders of dragons on the top and one of the sides. And so that's an interesting allusion to Chinese paper decoration, and it seems to be deliberately paired with the painting to create this kind of wonderful juxtaposition of what's called wa and kan, or Japanese and Chinese aesthetics that were brought together in interesting creative ways in the medieval period. So you have those square pieces of paper that are then pasted into an album. And as I mentioned, originally it would have been one album and probably in an accordion style, so that you would read one side and then flip it over and read the other side, dividing the 54 chapters in half. So today it's mounted between two beautiful brocade covers with mountings in gold, but it probably would have been slightly more informal mounting originally. Also, what's interesting about the shikishi, or these square papers that were used for both calligraphy and painting, is the flexibility of the format. So this is the wonderful thing about the unique formats of Japanese painting, is that you can take these square sheets and you can put paintings on them and text on them, and you can do this with fans as well, and then mount them into different formats, hanging scrolls, folding screens, and albums. And it's also thought that the set of paintings of 108 leaves of Genji were at some point mounted onto a pair of folding screens. And this is research that was done by Anne Rose Kitagawa, who is a former curator at the Harvard Art Museums. And she discerned patterns in the wear of the leaves that could only have been made if they had been folded up onto folding screens and put into storage. So at some point they were mounted on a screen, although in the original diary entries that describe this project, the commissioner describes pasting them into a soshi, or what we can assume is a kind of form of album. So they traveled, he took them back to his home provinces, and they assumed different forms throughout their history. So it's a very flexible format, and the text and the images were made separately. So the images were done, the paintings were done by Tosa Mitsunobu in his painting studio, and the calligraphy papers were executed by six different calligraphers who were each sent these papers by a coordinator. So the album's production context is very well known, and it's clear that the patron, whose name was Sue Saburo, who was working probably on behalf of his father as well, whose name was Sue Hiroaki, they were retainers of the Ouchi family, he requested Sanetaka to help him coordinate these album leaves. And he also had, as his assistant, a linked verse poet named Gensei, linked verse or denga being one of the most important forms of poetry in the Muromachi period. And so these individuals then determined which scenes and which excerpts from the text to select, and then probably sent them out to the calligraphers with instructions about which excerpts to use. And the six different men who were involved in the project each represented a different line of calligraphy school, which would have been known by the patron just by looking at the style, probably would have registered as a different house style, but also added to the wonderful visual diversity of the album. So you have six different calligraphers and five different colors of paper done in a very regimented order. But because there's a different number of calligraphers and painted leaves, then you have this wonderful kind of rainbow effect. Very rarely do you see the same calligraphy done on the same color of paper. And so there's a really wonderful kind of visual effect of this amalgamation of text and image coming together. So one interesting question, and we still don't know the answer to, is to what extent did Mitsunobu, the artist, respond to the textual excerpt? Was he given that in advance? Was he thinking about it? Was he just assigned a specific scene? Because we do know, for example, that in the medieval period, there were Genji menus for patrons to use in their selection of scenes for albums and other painting projects. So we actually don't know to what extent that the depth of that coordination and how much was known ahead of time by the artist. I would assume that the patron, though, had a lot of say in which scenes were selected. We know that from later well-documented examples of painting production, of Genji production in particular. But one of the things that I wanted to do in the book, and that I think is most rewarding interpretively, is to sort of just look at what we have. So we do have this juxtaposition of text and image, and what kind of interesting associations does it produce, regardless of what the intention was? So some of the scenes are very iconic. You see these paintings done again and again. The compositions are fairly reified. And yet when you put them with a different text, they can elicit all sorts of reactions on the part of the reader and viewer. So that makes the album really come alive to every different person who reads it and who has a different understanding of the tale of Genji.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Wow, this was such a beautiful answer and really comprehensive and raises so many issues as well. I'd like to continue, sort of ask a follow-up question because, you know, you talk about the juxtaposition or indeed interplay between the painting on the left-hand side and the calligraphy on the right-hand side. And there are certain qualities to Mitsunobu's painting and brushwork in particular that seem to echo the calligraphy in a way. Could you talk a bit more about the particularities of his painting style, the brushwork, and as well as the use of pigments that make his work in this album distinct?
So I think I can't be 100% certain that Mitsunobu actually was responding in his painting to the alignment of the calligraphy. I think in some cases the calligraphers might have even been given directions about how to compose their lines of text on the page, because there were in fact manuals for that as well. But in a lot of cases, they're probably just a happy accident in terms of how well the image seems calibrated to the text. In terms of Mitsunobu's style, so he was someone who was working in an age of efflorescence of Chinese ink painting. And although he's working in a mode of very thick mineral pigments and gold, which is associated with Japanese style painting, he was an artist who, especially in his other works, was very much interested in integrating Chinese ink painting styles into his work. So you see this especially in his hand scroll paintings, where he has this characteristic, very jagged line for the outline of rocks, for example, a very transparent approach to the application of blue for the sea and the sky. That really is not what we tend to associate with very thickly covered jewel-like images of the Tosa school. In the Genji album, that's less apparent, although it kind of sneaks in here and there in some of the rocks and trees, but also in the kind of roughness. And he seems to be okay with transparency in certain places. There's some damage as well that makes it hard to determine if that was intentional. But his Genji paintings look very different from everything we see later in the 17th century and Edo period albums of Genji. They're just earthier. They're softer, they're rougher, especially the faces of non-aristocrats, so the ones that aren't supposed to be showing a powdered white face. Those tend to be, they show the lines underneath coming through, and he seems to be kind of fine with that in a way that, to me, is very endearing. It makes these images much more approachable than some of the others, although the other ones, the later Genji album leaves have their own charms.
Now, talking about charm and approachability, let's continue to sort of discuss text and image relation. And I would like to talk about how the written tale of Genji is indeed famed for its astonishingly modern psychological complexity with theory of mind, subjectivity, and interiority. And these are some of the reasons why it's considered the first novel, putting other Eurocentric views of the birth of the modern novel in the modern era really in its place. but this... The complexity psychological complexity and the narrative techniques, so stream of consciousness are used and free and direct discourse as well, make the text so unique and modern in many ways. Yet in the paintings, the faces are not individualized and they're fairly generic. So there seems to be a stark sort of contrast or discrepancy between word, which is highly subjective and individualized and psychologically charged and complex, and the images that are not individualized and generic, at least when it comes to the faces. And yet we, or at least the informed viewer, is able to identify all the different characters and their individual traits. And so I would like you to talk about how this is achieved.
Thank you. Yes, so the album is, of course, not responding to the entire tale of Genji. It's about sort of these excerpts. And so it doesn't have that same sort of breadth of the textual content that you would have in longer hand scrolls, for example, like the original, not the original, but the earliest extant scrolls from the 12th century. I think those come closer in terms of being able to present more text and to have images then that respond to the written complexity of the tale. So those actually kind of convey some of the linguistic features of the Tale of Genji in image, in some ways better than the later album weaves do, which are responding to an excerpt, but also are not meant to be, are meant to be kind of supplements to a reader, as you said, an informed reader who knows these characters very well. But there are a couple of things that I could say in response to your question, in that, first of all, we tend to use these terms that we're comfortable with in terms of describing interiority that are derived from our encounter with the modern novel. But and they certainly work in many ways in describing what happens when you read the Tale of Genji in terms of the sense of really being in a character's mind and in several characters' mind at the same time, and characters who are thinking and projecting onto the thoughts of other characters, which is something that has always been remarked upon as being astounding for a work of this age. And so there is this kind of almost dangerous familiarity that we can have in reading the Tale of Genji, because in fact, as other scholars have pointed out, most importantly, Amanda Meyer Stinchcomb, and more recently, Keith Vincent and Tomiko Yoda, that the Tale of Genji has this alterity in its writing, in its linguistic forms that have to be accounted for. So things that are just inherent in classical Japanese read as sort of modern interiority, when in fact there's something much more complex going on. And so in that way, I think the images can really help as a corrective to that tendency to want to see the work purely in terms that we are familiar with. So to your point, you know, why is it that all of the faces seem to look the same? Well, in some ways, that there are many different reasons for that. By the time we get to the 16th century, there was a need for a very solid, kind of a robust kind of visual language of Genji that would be highly legible. And this resulted in this astoundingly kind of consistent representational style of courtly painting. So that was important in terms of communication abilities and of communicating such a long story and all of its different content and chapters to viewers. The ability of that common visual language enabled readers to kind of immediately understand what a painting was signifying because of the selection of certain motifs, for example. Another important thing is that these paintings necessitate a viewer who's going to read into them. And so in some ways, like the text, it's really asking for a kind of cognitive work that has to be done on the part of the viewer. So the paintings, to get the most out of them, you have to project all sorts of things into them in terms of reading beyond the moment that's being depicted. So I'm talking about the single leaf of an album right now, of an album painting. To really understand that image and to to read it in a kind of rewarding way, you want to think back to the moments that happened before that scene and forward in the novel to moments that happened after that scene in order to fully understand what's going on in the image. So it requires a kind of knowledge of the story to fill out what's not shown in the image. And then also the painting should be understood as one that is not naturalistic. And this is something that can be applied to the text as well. So although The Tale of Genji, and this is the reason it's probably, you know, lasted until this day as a beloved novel, although it's full of this kind of realistic style description, it's important to keep in mind that almost every place, every natural motif, every place name, every setting that's described is also symbolic. And this is really driven home when you look at the paintings, because the paintings, as I mentioned in the book, many of them function as kind of word motifs that are used, that have a kind of semantic value. They're images that have semantic value. And that's all, a lot of times that can be attributed to the fact that this is a work of art that comes out of a culture of poetry and a culture of poetic gatherings. So as I mentioned, you know, the creators of this album, one of the most integral figures was a Renga poet. And so there are traces of Renga imagery throughout the album in these motifs that could have been seen and spoken as words that you would use to compose a Renga verse. And so the images are part of this culture of the medieval period in which you had really, and not just Renga, but you had a kind of semantic web that was overlaying society with Renga production, but also Waka poetry production as well, that kind of shaped the way people viewed artistic production. And so although the images might seem simple, there is this important integration with the poetic word and often the prose as well that makes them more complex.
Wow, and this leads me to wonder what you think, how much of that knowledge is lost today, or indeed do you believe that we are still today able to decode all of this incredibly, you know, the incredible complexity that you just described in its entirety today?
It's really hard to read it that way. So much work has been done in by Japanese scholars writing in Japanese about each individual chapter that helps. And so I think, you know, it'd be wonderful to have in English a full explication of every single chapter of The Tale of Genji as a kind of series. That would be interesting to help readers, I think, really understand the depth of symbolism and allusions that occur on the sentence level, actually.
Well, I think credit due where credit's due. You do this really beautifully for this particular album, and you do exactly what you've just described, which is reading into the painting both what happened before and after, and then describing what is, you know, happening, which scene was chosen from the chapter for this particular painting. And so you do that really quite beautifully, and it is a great help to any reader who's trying to understand a bit better the tale itself as well as visual interpretations of it.
Shall we talk about one of the examples?
Yes, I would love to.
You could look at chapter 4, Yugo. That's one of my favorites in terms of looking ahead as to what happens in subsequent scenes from the one being depicted. So this is a painting that is paired with one single poem, which often happens in the album. And it's a poem that is spoken by Genji. And I can go ahead and just read the English translation, which is by Edmund Cranston, that's in the book. And I should set the stage first. And that is Genji has been courting Yugao, this woman. He first heard about her in chapter 2 as this lost lover of Tono Chūjō, his brother-in-law and rival and friend. So Tono Chūjō had this lover named Yūgao, and they had a daughter together. But this lover has run away, sort of is in hiding because she's been threatened by Tono Chūjō's official wife. So Genji comes upon this woman as he's visiting his old nursemaid, and he begins seeing her. And in the scene in the painting, he is at her residence, which is very far from what he's used to at the palace in the imperial court. And this is a famous scene in which he hears all of these sounds from a neighborhood that he's not used to being in, because the residences are sort of cheek by jowl, so close together that he can hear people waking up in the morning and so forth. And the scene is so full of evocative sound imagery. And the painting really captures that by showing, for example, two women in the upper right corner who are pounding cloth, the word for which is kimuta, and that is itself an important poetic word. And so that's a kind of interesting visual image that is directly related to poetry composition. And then Genji also hears the sound of a religious pilgrim. And in the painting, this is actually one case which is, it's quite an unusual rendition of the scene. It has that pilgrim actually kneeling in the lower left corner, and he's has his hands clasped together in prayer. He's going to be on his way to a pilgrimage, and he's facing a shelf with these white paper streamers called gohe. And Genji hears him reciting, sort of praying, and then Genji recites this poem to Yūgao, and he's going to, this evening, he's going to whisk her away to this deserted mansion where, unfortunately, she will meet her end at the hands of a pretty frightening phantom. Most people think it's Lady Rokujō, her spirit, but in any case, so Genji hears these sounds, and he composes this poem to Yūgao, and he says about the man who's praying, he says, "This lay devotee practices the way. Oh, let it be our guide. Even in the lives to come, do not betray our deep vow." So it's, you know, can be taken as Genji sort of making the most of the situation, hearing this religious pilgrim and then composing a poem that's all about his kind of worldly love for Yūgao as a way to woo her. On the other hand, when you look at this poem, which is on the leaf next to the painting, juxtaposed with the imagery in the painting, it has interesting reverberations. So you start to think about actually the words in the poem, the religious meaning of the poem, not just the romantic scenario, but how both can be sort of overlaid with spiritual meaning. And that poem is important because at the time that the album was created in the 16th century, it was actually spoken in a no play about the character Yūgao. And as your listeners probably know, no plays were very much integrated with Buddhist philosophy. So it seems to me that Tsunobu was sort of inserting this image of the pilgrim to do that kind of work, to bring out these kind of nuances of Yūgao's character. But what was especially striking to me in analyzing this painting was that Genji is shown in a robe, a red robe, which has all sorts of beautiful gold patterns on it. But that's a color that he never wears again in the entire album. So he appears a lot in this album before chapter 41 when he leaves the story, but never is he shown in a red robe. And if you read forward in the chapter, in chapter 4, what you'll find is that after Yūgao dies and her body is disposed of or taken to a temple for cremation by Genji's fixer, Koremitsu, Genji goes to visit her corpse. And he actually recounts, the chapter recounts a description of him looking at the corpse, which has been wrapped in this red robe that we see in the painting, in the album. So after she died, you know, Koremitsu did what he could. He wrapped the body. She had been wearing the robe. He kept the body in the robe and then wrapped her up in the mat they had been sleeping on. But in this remarkable passage, so Genji is described visiting her, you know, her dead body, and commenting on the robe. So in that way, with that knowledge of what happens later in the chapter, you can look at this painting very differently. All of a sudden, Genji wearing the robe, looking at Yuga, who has her back to the viewer in the painting. It seems like a foreshadowing of this, you know, ominous death that's about to come.
I think, and you've mentioned this a bit now in your discussion of this one particular painting, I think this sort of helping the viewer to understand better the before and after, and placing this scene within the chapters as such, is also helped by the format of the album, which is, of course, you know, which allows for both an intimate as well as an embodied viewing, in which you sort of turn the pages as you go along through the chapter. You've mentioned this before as well, but I just want to come back to it maybe. And then also particular stylistic features, such as the blowing of roofs, as well as the clouds. And I was wondering whether you could talk about this a bit more, because it's particular to this album, but it also is repeated in many ways, not repeated, not copied, of course, but sort of echoed in other visual interpretations of the tale.
Yes, thank you. So these conventions of narrative painting are just remarkably consistent, and you'll see them in Genji paintings into the 20th century, and they involve, like you mentioned, this feature of the so-called blown-off roof, in which you can peer down into domestic settings, interior settings, and see the characters interacting. One of the things that's interesting about that technique is that, you know, it's a later term that art historians applied to the technique. So it actually presupposes a roof. But if you think about it, sort of narrative painting, especially in its very earliest formation, probably done by, you know, readers of tales early on who are building these images just based on what they're reading, it probably started with the characters themselves and the kind of interpersonal relationship between figures in paintings, and then the settings maybe grew up around them in a way. So, you know, the fact that it doesn't have a roof, it maybe is sort of, it's strange that we use that term in some ways, because the most important things for these images are actually the work of the characters and their interpersonal goings on in the settings. But the lack of that rooftop does kind of signal to the viewer that you're in a kind of different pictorial space than you might be familiar with. So I think that also lets them know that this is a tradition where you should sort of question your assumptions about how it should be viewed. And the other aspect of the painting that does that are the gold clouds, which are also not meant to be kind of naturalistic. And as I said before, you know, this has been a long process of probably the conventionalization of the gold cloud motif over centuries. And now in the 16th century, they're very opaque. Mitsunobu's clouds have rounded outlines and small pieces of gold on the outline, as well as opaque gold paint in the middle. But they waft over all different parts of the scene, and they perform different functions. So in one sense, they create spatial cell. So I mentioned in that chapter 4 painting, you have this image of two women pounding cloth in the upper right. They are set off between gold clouds that allows us to think of them, even in the small space of this rectangle, as somewhat distant from Genji, perhaps. They can perform, the gold clouds can then sort of elide space. It can be farther than an actual spatial distance would actually be in the image. They also function rhetorically to emphasize certain figures in the paintings. And so you'll often, in this album, see the gold cloud just hovering right over Genji's head, sort of letting the viewers know that he is the actual protagonist of the scene. That happens quite a bit. They function that way as pointers. And this is something that happens in hand scrolls and narrative painting all throughout Japanese art history. So these Conventions are ones that viewers learn to read. One thing, you know, just to jump ahead to the exhibition, the designers at the Metropolitan Museum of Art did a wonderful job of painting the wall of the entrance to the museum black and then applying actual gold leaf vinyl clouds on the wall to sort of let the museum goers know that when they open these doors and enter into these rooms, they'll be entering into this kind of special space, not naturalistic. This is a magical sort of fictional world of the tale. And in many ways, the Genji paintings, on whether they be on screens or albums or fans, those gold clouds are sort of telling you as well that this is a kind of alternative, you know, liminal space that you're entering into.
No, I think that's a really, really good point because, you know, these pages are so beautifully constructed in a way, I think, or designed. And you talked about how you wanted to make this as close as possible sort of reading experience whilst at the same time helping anybody, you know, whether they're able to read Japanese or not, to sort of understand the calligraphy better. So I think that's a really good one. Shall we sort of record this properly again, or do you want me to just, yeah, okay. So I'll take a short sort of moment and then start again. So there are so many different aspects that we've spoken about now, and you've sort of already started introducing or talking about the exhibition, which we'll come on to in the next part of the interview. But before we go on to do that, is there anything else that you would like to cover in this interview that we haven't mentioned? And a little note to the reader, for example, about this beautifully produced and magnificent Tale of Genji of the Harvard album.
Okay, thank you. So if I could say one last thing about the book, it would be just a thanks to my editor, Michelle Comey, and the production members of the production team at Princeton University Press. They allowed me to put Japanese in my book, which isn't always the case, and which let me put the transcription in Japanese of every calligraphic sheet in the album right below it, alongside a romanization of the transcription, and then the full English translation beneath the painting. And this was something that I really wanted to do so that the book would speak to many different types of readers. So those who are just starting out learning Japanese, those who are more advanced in their Japanese language training, who would like to, for example, learn how to read the calligraphy leaves on their own. They can do that by looking down at the passage and seeing, and its transcription, seeing how it was done and how the abbreviated characters are made, but then also that the book would allow for readers who have no background in Japanese language and can appreciate the painting alongside the wonderful translations of Edwin Cranston and then Dennis Washburn, whose prose translation I used. So I'm grateful to them, and I hope that the book will allow readers to come up with their own interpretations of the Tale of Genji. I should mention that in addition to the description of the paintings, the book is also, to the extent that these sort of individual scenes from one from each chapter allowed me to do so, an account of how I read the Tale of Genji, how I've taught it for 20 years in terms of my own interpretation of the story. And in addition to the book, there's also the album fully reproduced, fully illustrated on the website of the Harvard Art Museum. So readers can go to that site and zoom in on the pictures and come up with their own interpretations of the story and the pictures as well.
That's so great. Thank you so much, Melissa, for your time today and for talking to me about The Tale of Genji, a visual companion, published in 2018 by Princeton University Press. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.